Tonight, we got the top dog at Pink Poodle Productions, head of IP strategy and acquisitions for Rain Shine Entertainment, Miss Marlene Sharp. Stay tuned.
Talking Junk Network,
where entertainment lives.
Welcome to Talking Junk.
I'm your host, Jason Melendez.
Live now every week on Friday.
Talking Junk.
A multitude of professionals in different aspects, different walks of life.
You have to come on and talk junk like a normal person.
And I forgot to unmute myself as well as put myself on screen. So this is a typical night, little bumps and hiccups there, but thank you for tuning in. This is Talking Junk Network, Talking Junk on the Talking Junk Network, coming to you live every Friday night with another wonderful guest for you. Let me just bring her on because I'm tired of stumbling over my own words. Let me stumble over some sentences, questions for Miss Marlene Sharp. How are you doing tonight, Marlene?
Hi, very well, thank you. Wow, that's an epic introduction. You're amazing. I'm already so impressed, and we're just starting.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That means a lot.
This is probably one of the most epic, impressive, magnificent intros ever that I've had on a podcast or pretty much anywhere else. So kudos.
Wow, that means a lot. That really does, because you're no stranger to production.
That's true. Yeah, so all accolades to you.
Thank you very much, and I will make sure I take this snippet and put it everywhere on every social media platform.
Yes, maximize it, monetize it, milk it, whatever. Yours to keep.
How was your work week?
It was pretty busy. I have a lot of things going on right now, so yeah, it was busy. And what about yourself? How was your work week?
Pretty busy. On top of this lovely podcast network with three podcasts on it, we tried to have the 40-hour work week on top of a family. I'm married, so there's a lot of things. I'm trying to get the hell out of working for somebody, so there's dreams and aspirations. Taking a little bit of training to be a public speaker, so there's a lot of things in there. little things. Nothing compared to you, though.
Oh, well, it's all marketing. So it's smoke and mirrors. That's the key.
Okay. Well, smoke and mirrors, they do the trick. They get you out there.
Yes, yes.
How did you start making a name for yourself? Where did Miss Marlene Sharp start?
Well, gosh, Miss Marlene Sharp started way back in New Orleans when I was born. I think I was born this way because very, very early on, I started telling my parents, you need to be in the audience. Only I'm on the stage. this was at home. So it wasn't even in public. I wanted to be on the stage even when no one was watching. So
you sound like a 7-year-old.
Oh, really? Right. Is your 7-year-old a girl or a boy?
Yeah, she is.
Oh, okay.
Jenna, well, she is very outgoing.
Jenna, look out. Or actually, we should be telling the world to look out for you.
Oh, they certainly need to look out.
Wow. Yeah. Well, it can start early. My parents brought me to a lot of children's theater starting when I was about 2 years old. So I think that might have influenced it. And then I watched a ton of TV. And what else? Oh, yeah. As far as getting the word out, I used to make little invitations and give them out in kindergarten, much to my mother's dismay, because she would find out that I had created some kind of social gathering unbeknownst to her, and other mothers would approach her in the school parking lot or what have you and say, oh, that's the cutest thing, Marlene's little invitations, and yes, Lisa will be at your house tomorrow. And my mom never thought to question why I was coming in to ask her, how do you spell this, or what's Lisa's mom's name, or whatever. She just thought I was precocious little weird kid, but it turned into something.
It certainly turned into something. So after your passion, obviously coming at an early age, what were the next steps for you to try to, when did you notice that this is exactly where you wanted to be?
Well, pretty much when I started watching Sesame Street, that was probably the pivotal moment. There was the build up with the children's theater and telling my parents, only you were in the audience. I'm on the stage. We used to make recordings for my cousins who lived out of town. And so we would do it at the holiday seasons and so forth. And I always wanted to sing all the Christmas carols and give all the news of the day and what have you. So there was it was a slow build up to when I was like, you know, 2.5 or something and watching Sesame Street. And then I asked my mom one day, something about Sesame Street and like how to get there. I mean, isn't that what everybody wants to know? It's in the theme song, of course.
I still want to know.
But I think one day we were driving past the PBS affiliate in New Orleans, and my mom must have said something that made that connection that, oh, Sesame Street and PBS and what have you. And so then it was an aha moment. And so I said, Mom, can we go in there and meet Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch and the whole gang? And she said, no, because the show isn't made here. It's made in New York. And then she tried to explain in simple terms syndication to me. Not syndication, I'm sorry. Location production or whatever it was, you know, that related to this situation.
This is filmed here and it's shot to so you can see it here.
Yeah, it's filmed, it's recorded somewhere else, but we can see it where we live, and this place is like the intermediary for the whole area that we live in. And so then that was a very pivotal moment, because then I was like, wait a minute, show business isn't in New Orleans? What the hell? I need to get where it is. And so then when I was old enough to to check out books from the library in grammar school or whatever, I would get books like How to Get Your Kid into Show Business or, you know, Screenwriting 101, whatever. And I'd check out all these books and I'd bring them home. I'd tell my mom I needed an agent. And it was highly unrelatable to my family because I did not come from a show business family. We lived in the Deep South. There was not really anything nearby. I mean, and this is years and years ago. So New Orleans has come up in the world as far as a place for location shooting since right. then. But when I was a kid, it was the dark ages and that was not happening. So then I realized that really
the only thing at that time that came out of Louisiana was good food and voodoo.
Exactly.
And good music.
And the occasional corrupt politician. That would happen.
Everywhere now.
Yes, I know. Well, in New Orleans, we had the market cornered on that, but it spread. I guess it infiltrated. So anyway, so I started with my library research and whatnot, and discovered that New York and Los Angeles were pretty much the go-to places for show business. And I decided that Los Angeles sounded more like me because sunshine and that the movie stars, the beach, and although I never go to the beach, but it just sounded like more it sounded like more of an environment that I would thrive in. So that's what I set my sights on that early. And I ended up moving. I did it again in stages. It wasn't kind of like I teleported here or anything. I am in Los Angeles right now, just so you know. But I came by way of San Diego. So I went to college in New Orleans at Loyola University, New Orleans, and then went to graduate school at San Diego State University. So went to San Diego, then moved to Orange County for a year and worked there, and then came to Los Angeles, and I've been here for 100 years. And that's how I got here.
You look good for a 200-year-old woman.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you would think that since an early age you were stage starved, why aren't you an actress at the moment?
Well, in theory, I am. And that's an excellent question, by the way, and one that I yearn to answer in case there are any casting people out there. I'm available and I'm ready. I also have a duet partner whose name is Blanche Dubois Sharp, my furry child here. So we are also available as a mother dog daughter team.
Thank you for being a friend.
Exactly. Yes, yeah, she's my golden girl. You might hear from her later in the show, but for now she's occupied. But yeah, so I did perform and I have performed and this is performing right now. So I love to go on people's podcasts and shows and whatnot. But in 2013, I took a step back from my acting. It was just getting too stressful because I had never really been able to make a living at acting. It was always the kind of thing where I was working in the business and very fortunate to have done so, to have been working in offices, creative offices, doing a variety of different things through the years. But I was never really, I was never cast as a series regular on a show where I could make a living off of that. It was like sneaking off to auditions here and there. And I learned very quickly when I came to LA that you must keep your acting separate from your other work.
It's a shame too, because you drip charisma.
Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you so much. Wow. You're an angel. Thank you. I might start crying a little bit because that's very,
I'll cry with you.
Very sweet.
It's a chain reaction.
Aw. Well, anyway, so in 2013, 2013 was a very difficult year for me for a variety of reasons. And so I had agents that I was working with for voiceover and on camera and so forth. And I said, I can't sneak off anymore to auditions. It's just too soul crushing. And then a couple of times I actually booked some really cool acting jobs that I couldn't do because my regular job was so stressful and demanding, and I couldn't afford to just walk away from those jobs. And those jobs were hard to get. I had to fight hard to get them. It's not easy to work behind the scenes in entertainment either. But I felt like I was really at the point where I had to make a choice. So I did. And I haven't really been actively pursuing acting since then. But what I tell people is that I'm offer only now. So I don't audition, but if you want to just cast me in something, let's talk.
Now the money talks. See?
Exactly. So it's quite difficult. Maybe slightly easier now with the self-taping, and since the pandemic really changed the scenario with, like, you know, people being able to record themselves at home and then
Changed the landscape for a lot of things.
Yeah. So that did make things become more accessible, but also that's really like the first step is putting yourself, you know, recording yourself and sending it in for an audition. If you get callback, because it's usually not just one audition and then boom, you've got the role. It's like this process, and step two or step three or step 10 is showing up in person at the studio and waiting for your turn and doing the reading with either another actor or the casting director. Yeah. So it is quite time consuming. And it was also soul crushing too. Cause you have to go through like 100 rejections before you get cast in something. And
you have to have tough skin.
And then, but one of the worst feelings in the world is to get cast in something and not be able to do it because you have some obligation elsewhere that is not your first choice, but it must be because you have to make a living. So So my goal is to mimic the career of Betty White, where she really reached the peak of her fame and fortune when she was 90, I think. I mean, that was 90 to 99. Those were her years where she was everywhere. So I'm thinking, like, when I turn 90, that will be my time to just focus completely on acting and auditioning and, but until then, I've got these other pursuits that keep me busy.
Well, you just said you was 100, so you missed it 10 years ago.
Oops. Yeah. I mean, I meant 190. That's what I meant. It's hard to keep track.
My next question was going to be if you did any voiceover work, but you said you stopped the acting and the voiceovering. So that was all connected together.
Yes. Well, I did a lot of voiceover acting previously, like especially a lot of dubbing of foreign material.
Like anime and stuff.
Anime and also just live action. And there's a phenomenon known, well, you might know, but it's called looping. And also Walla is part of that. And it's groups of people that get together and do all the background sounds or not sounds, but like crowd scenes and dubbing smaller roles in film and TV. So I worked on a show called Reno 911. Big show. And so that's live action, and it's of course spoken English, but there are small roles that maybe they filmed on location somewhere. And rather than, it's actually less expensive for the production to hire a loop group. There are these groups that form that are like a collective, and then they're hired by the production to just come in and in one fell swoop do all these different voices and dub all the voices that can't be heard because they're you know, recorded on the street corner or right. at the ocean.
So you're basically vocal extras.
Yes. Yes. Okay. But sometimes your vocal principles, because and I always feel bad for the actor who is on screen and it's, you know, it's probably their big break or, you know, it's a break, it's a credit for them, but then they have to be dubbed over because it's just cheaper to have the Loop Group, because the Loop Group gets paid a collective. Well, we do get paid as SAG actor. It's kind of complicated.
You split the tips.
It works out to be cheaper for the production to have like one group of people who can go there in one day and just, you look at the screen, you hear the beeps in your ear, and then you match your voice to the lip flaps and you do it a few times. And then that, and it's also great for character actors, because then you have a chance to do all these different voices. Sometimes you're voicing a child, or like in my case, I've voiced a lot of little kids, boys and girls, because the voices are fairly similar when people are children. So yeah, I did a lot of that, but not so much anymore. For a variety of reasons, mostly because it's hard as I've moved up in the world as a producer, I have more and more responsibility, and just to go off and do these jobs, it's quite time consuming. And
right.
I ran into the same problem with stand-up comedy too. I did that for a while, but man, is that time consuming.
You look like you'd be a great stand-up comedian.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it, and it's, I am in so in awe of everybody who's ever had a Netflix comedy special. Like, I watch everything because I'm just obsessed with it. But to generate your own material and then try it out, you have to write a whole lot. Then you have to find some kind of safe place to try it in front of like a class or a little audience that won't be too judgmental. Right. And then you have to get yourself booked in venues, which, and also like LA is one of the hardest places to do stand up, I think, because
man, nowadays you need a bodyguard just to do stand up.
Yes. When I was doing it, it wasn't so physically violent or risky. Right. But yes, it certainly has gotten more so through the years. But it's just hard. You've got to book yourself in places all over, and there are a lot of people who are doing it out here. So that, like, if you were in a small town somewhere, maybe there wouldn't be as many other aspiring stand-ups. But in LA, everybody's an aspiring something, right. And then also the whole life is really hard, because when you're not a headliner, you end up doing these late night showcase open mic type of things, and then in order to get stage time, you need to bring in audience member, like people who will pay the two drink minimum. And then if you don't do that, you either don't get to go on stage or you have to pay it out of your pocket. And then wow. Parking around here is rough. And then what else? The traffic, just getting to and from.
Hey, I'm from New York. You don't got to explain LA.
Oh, yeah. Well, LA is, yes, I'm sorry. Don't mean to Marlene-splain to you.
No, no, that's fine.
This is for the audience members who might not be familiar with the whole grind in the big city. But yeah, it's so gratifying when you're on stage. But I also discovered pretty early on that my people, like the people who would be potential fans and patrons of my art, are not necessarily the people who attend late night alcohol fueled comedy venues. The place where I really killed was this little coffee shop in San Dimas that was mostly geriatrics in the audience. It was like the 70 and over crowd. I mean,
you would kill at nursing homes.
Exactly.
I know a guy that works at one if you're looking for somewhere to start your comedy.
Oh,
your comedy.
Really? Right. Wow. Noted. Duly noted.
Matt, did you? I know a lot of voiceover people usually have the one voice where they say, you know, this is the one. I wish this one went places. You know what I mean? Or I can eat off of this one. What's the one voice that you think that you could have went that far with?
You're listening to it.
The original voice. Okay. Yes. I get it. You're absolutely right. You do have a unique voice to you. It's not quite Sarah Silverman voice, but you have it's a very unique voice. I would be able to tell it's you after hearing you from a couple of different things.
Thank you. I'll take that as a compliment, along with the others that I'm collecting from this experience. Thank you.
So what was after you went to work in the back, what was your biggest production just starting off that you felt, you know, this feels good. I made it.
You mean like behind the scenes or
yeah, acting once you,
or whatever?
Well, once you made your transition to the back.
Okay. Well, this I can tell you what I thought was my. Well, there were a couple of things, maybe a few things, maybe a lot of things that I thought were my big break that never really. I feel like I'm still waiting for my big break, is what I'm saying. But okay. I can tell you some things that I thought were really special, and then most of them turned into tragedies or crushed expectations at the end. But one of the big projects that I worked on was a musical film called High in the Clouds, and it is based on a children's book by Paul McCartney. So I worked with Paul McCartney for a little bit. Wow. To develop this book into a big screen.
That's not a name drop.
Yeah.
One of the biggest.
That's probably the biggest. And he used to come to our office. It was when I was working for a company called RGH Entertainment, and Paul McCartney would come. It was always quite funny when he would come to the office, because we would only get about a half an hour's notice from his assistant, who this lovely British lady would call and say, Paul's on his way. You have about 15 minutes or you have 30 minutes. And then it would be this fire drill in the office. I'm not kidding you. People would run in all directions. Somebody would take off to the grocery store to get this unusual yeast paste that he liked to eat on crackers and bread. I'm sure there's a name for it, but I can't remember what it's called. And, you know, various other like British-y types of foods that he liked, and you know, we could clean up and you know, everybody get ready, and then the car would pull up, and we were in a very low-key
Marmite
park, and I'm sorry, what
was it?
Marmite, maybe. That sounds really familiar. Marmite, it could have been that
Marmite yeast extract paste.
Yes, it was some kind of, it was a yeast paste. It was, yes, that must be it.
Or maybe Vegemite.
Could have been that too. Yes, because, well, I don't know if it makes a difference, because he is a very strict vegetarian. So maybe we did get the veggie virgin version of it.
The veggie virgin. All right.
Oh, there we go. Okay, Marmite. Yes, that packaging looks really, that one looks very familiar. And it has a very pungent smell to it, which luckily we are spared that, because we're not in person. But anyway, yeah, that's what, if a fan of Paul McCartney out there wants to send him a gift, that is sure to be a hit, because he loves it. That's what he ate when he came to our office. And we were in a very low-key office park. It was low-key and like very modest. You would never guess that anything special was going on there. We were right across the street from CHP state trooper's office and a preschool, and it was just like anybody could walk in. It was like not locks on the door or anything. And so
the best way to hide is in plain sight.
Exactly. It was in plain sight. And then, like, I thought, okay, Paul McCartney, he must travel incognito somewhat, because he wouldn't want crazy fans to be stalking him or whatever.
Right.
No, not so much. He came, every time he came to our office, he was in a purple Corvette. And it wasn't even like lavender or, you know, light periwinkle blue. It was purple. So it pulled focus from the rest of the cars. Yeah, definitely stood out. And it was like a vintage Corvette. So it, you know, was all wavy and swirly like they were. And I think he used to drive it, but he had his friend, his long-term like bodyguard slash assistant would go with him everywhere. So I think either one of them would be driving, and then he would just pull up. And we were also, our office was like, our unit was right next to Cal Lutheran University. They had like a little satellite extension to Cal Lutheran University next to us. So occasionally people who were taking classes there would come outside to like smoke or chat or eat snacks, and they'd be hanging out outside with and Paul McCartney would drive up, and it would just cause just a massive massive, it would only be like maybe 10 people, but then it was just like everybody pulling out their phones and snapping photos, and so we witnessed this a couple of times, and it was so funny because people would, it would take a moment. You would see it register on people's faces, like, wait, like first the purple car and then Paul McCartney, and they'd be trying to process, you know, what are these things meaning when they're put together? Oh my God. And then, you know, the frenzy would start, and then he'd hurry into our office. But yeah, so I worked on that off and on, because I had other stuff that I was working on at the time, but I was involved here and there, this and that, for a couple of years. And then I left that company and went to Sega, actually, to work on Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic the Hedgehog became my boss, not Paul McCartney anymore. And
it was the movie, right? Not the game.
I worked very in a very obscure capacity on movie one for Sonic the Hedgehog, but I was actually hired to work on the second season of Sonic Boom, which was our TV show on Cartoon Network in the US, an animated show. And so I came in for the second season. So I have a background working on a lot of merchandise driven intellectual properties, mostly for dudes, a lot of them based on video games or comic books or manga.
Our weaknesses.
Yes, that type of thing, which is a little weird because I am the girliest girl you'll ever meet. I am all about pink. I just installed a pink refrigerator in my place. I am
got the pink headphones.
And if you could see my place, it's all like pink and white and adorable and stuff. Like, think of a place where Hello Kitty might live, and that's this place. And but I've only ever worked on stuff like, well, early days or early in my career, I worked on Power Rangers. Then there's Sonic the Hedgehog. I worked on some other Sega properties too, but always on the TV and film side. So like, I'm not a game designer or game programmer, although it's very important when you're working on something that's a brand
history.
You must, in order to make all the parts of this character or this franchise work together, it's very important to know, especially what's at the core, if it's a video game character like Sonic. Well, everything at Sega, it's a video game at its core, and then it splinters off into all these other manifestations. But you really have to understand the games, the fans of the games, and the history, the canon, all that stuff. And so that's how I got into the Sonic. My Sonic experience was through the TV side, through Sonic Boom.
Okay. Well, when you did work with the movie, I have to ask you a question. It's very controversial.
Okay. I bet I could guess what it is, but go ahead.
How did you feel about the first draft, Sonic?
Well, I got to tell you, I have come to love Ugly Sonic as if he was one of my own children. And I can tell you my relationship with Ugly Sonic, if you would like to know. I will try to make it a short story.
Sure. You could go as long as you need. My daughter is going to love it. She loves Sonic.
Okay. Well, some of this story includes factoids that are not very well known outside of this little arena.
A Talking Junk Network exclusive.
Exactly. Exactly. So anyway,
you heard it here first.
Yes. And it's not really top secret, but it's like sort of just little known. So full disclosure, I was not working at Sega when Ugly Sonic made his big splash on the internet. It broke the internet back in early 2020 or late, no, no, it was late 2019. So after Sega, I went to work at Level 5, which is pretty much like Sega, except it's Level 5. And my boss was Jibanyan, the yokai, instead of Sonic the Hedgehog. I did a lot of work on a show called Yokai Watch, and I also worked on another show called Snack World. Inazuma 11 was another one, Ni no Kuni, a whole slew of Japanese video game-based properties. And Level 5 had an office in Los Angeles, as did Sega, and I just moved over there, was doing similar work, but for Level 5 instead of Sega. Right. And so I had recruited one of my former Sega co-workers to come over to Level 5 and do social media there. So Sergio Montalegre is the former co-worker who joined me at Level 5. And so we were always very plugged into what our former co-workers at Sega were doing. And of course, we were following the movie stuff really closely as it got close, because it was getting closer and closer to when the movie was coming out. And let me tell you, this movie was in development for like 10 years. There are probably hundreds of people worldwide who worked on this movie in various capacities through the years. And it just, things just take a long time, and people who aren't in the industry don't necessarily hear about it. But even the thousands of people you see in the credits on the screen is only representative of a small fraction of people who were involved, like in the physical production. Usually, like
imagine
all the consumer products people and the tech and infrastructure and so forth for Sega, and all the game people, whatever. Most of them are left out of the credits. I was not in the credits either, and I feel like I played an important part in the movie, which we can discuss at another time. But anyway, so well, getting
we're,
back
to- we're gonna watch it from now on, both one and two, and we're gonna know in our hearts that Marlene Sharp should be in the credits.
Yes, please do that, because I will feel it.
Trust me, my daughter watches it all the time. I walk in and say, Marlene was on there.
That's great. That's fantastic. And I'm so happy for all the success and everything. But I gotta say, I really identify with Ugly Sonic, because I have felt like an ugly duckling for a good bit of my life. And so I just, like, now, that being said, Sergio and I did have some chuckles behind the scenes when we were at Level 5, seeing the huge to-do that happened when the footage came out. And I knew the pain that they were feeling, because I worked on Sonic Boom, and Sonic Boom had a lot of the same blowback it was Sonic's first non-game screen appearance as a CG character. His arm color was changed, and that made a lot of people upset.
The whole shape of Knuckles was absurd.
Yeah, yeah. There are a bunch of issues that we heard a lot about. So we were like, oh, well, not our problem anymore. But oh, poor feature film people getting the blowback, but secretly we were like, you know, there was a little bit of, what is it? They call it Schadenfreude in the business when you're, it's a German word, I think, that means you're happy when other people have misfortune. It happens, especially in show
business. One of my co-hosts on Saturday night would have known that right off the bat. He's semi-fluent in German, so he's...
yeah, I'm sure it has some other meaning. It probably has like an authentic meaning in the original language, and then it has morphed into this term that Hollywood folks love to use when they describe other people's misfortunes and then the gleeful reaction of their frenemies.
Right.
That's what it's become. But anyway, so we chuckled a little bit about Ugly Sonic, and but we were like, well, you know, it happens with Sonic Boom, and it's that kind of blowback filtered down to the Sonic Boom games and the merchandise and everything, and ultimately Sonic Boom was canceled. The whole franchise. It was like,
did you get a credit for Sonic Boom?
Ugh. I did, but it was not the credit that I deserved, in my opinion. I bled blue for that show, and I was just sadly lumped together with a bunch of other people who were fine people at Sega. We were just all lumped together as Sega team or Sega production team, or like,
oh wow, okay,
also they ran
one of those things.
Yeah, it was really Sonic Boom had a lot of issues that that I probably shouldn't talk about because NDAs were signed and so forth, but
okay.
But anyway,
we don't want you to get in trouble for talking junk here.
Yeah exactly. Well, just know that there was junk. It happened, and we've moved on. But I'm
Don't
here
worry.
to
we'll
share
talk
with
about
you.
It when the cameras aren't recording.
So anyway, back to Ugly Sonic, because that was your question. So anyway, couple of years pass. I see movie one. I see movie two. I am still really good friends with a lot of my former coworkers. Some of them are still at Sega, some of them aren't. And so I am involved as a mentor with a school, an animation school for adults on the autism spectrum.
And
this is relevant to the story. So don't worry.
Even if it wasn't, that's amazing.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, great.
Yeah, I have an autistic niece, so it's that's amazing.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, that's a whole other show we can have about the folks at Brainstorm Productions.
Oh, you're welcome back on anytime.
Oh, great. Great. Yeah, I have that's my a whole other soapbox that I have. But anyway, so part of my shepherding this group of animation trainees through their career journey is bringing in a lot of my potential guest speakers and friends from the industry to speak with them, mostly over Zoom. So I invited Chuck Williams, who's one of the producers of the Sonic movie, movie one, and Chiako Slawinski, who was also very instrumental on the film, who did not get a credit. I don't think she did, not even in a whole big list of people. And Chiako worked on that movie for several years. But anyway, Chiako and Chuck have their own company now, and they're actually producing the new Pac-Man movie, which is in development. And they're doing a lot of other things, a lot of video game to screen adaptations. So I invited them to do a Zoom presentation for the students. And Chuck, at least half of the presentation, I could not believe this. Chuck took responsibility for Ugly Sonic. And my students were riveted. They were, because he brought out all this concept art and he showed it on the screen. And he's like, this is how we got from this to this. And what happened was there were two factions. There were Sega folks, like people who were employees of Sega, whose paychecks came from Sega, and who were very knowledgeable about Sonic and the fandom and all that. Then there were the movie people, and the movie people were kind of, or some of them were new to the party. So they had big jobs in the structure of the movie, but they were not necessarily organically Sonic fans, like from the beginning. And right. So one of these people is Neil Moritz, the executive producer of all the Fast and Furious movies. And if you see either of the Sonic movies, you see his name big and bold in the credits. He had to be convinced through the years. His involvement did not come from a childhood love of Sonic. So people who were not so familiar with the whole Sonic franchise wanted to make Sonic this dark, scary character for that was the vision. And so this faction, some of them on the creative side, some of them were on the business side, got together, formulated this design of Sonic, which was horrifying. It's the stuff of nightmares. It is a very like photoreal looking hedgehog that is blue. So it almost looks like it's post-mortem.
The things out of nightmares.
Both like zombie Sonic or something. I mean, but all kind of like with these Gollum claws. I mean, it was truly disturbing. So Chuck had all this original art. I couldn't believe he was showing it to us, but I was like, go for it. You know, the students are riveted. So he showed us that and he's like, so this was the movie people liked this. And then of course there were the Sega people whose paychecks come from Sega, who were like, no, Sonic, this is Sonic. This is the Sonic that the fans are expecting. Right.
I don't know what that monstrosity is that you cooked up on paper, but this is the blue one we love.
Right, right. And so, God love him, Aaron Weber, who is one of my Sonic heroes, who is responsible for so much of the success of Sonic in the last few years. He was the head of social media from our LA office, and then he actually went on and worked at Sega Japan after the first movie came out. But anyway, Aaron was very vocal in like, look, I talk to the fans every day and this is a disaster waiting to happen. Please, please don't do this. So then Chuck, my friend who was giving this presentation, was functioning as a mediator. So he was like, because both sides, there was a stalemate. The movie people were like, no, we want scary Sonic. And then the Sega people, no, we want authentic Sonic. And so Chuck kept trying to inch them closer together. And the way that happened was like each side would adapt their art a little bit, like, oh, well, maybe we can include this element or maybe we can include that element, trying to reach an artistic compromise.
Right.
Sadly, try to blend them. Yes. The compromise is ugly Sonic. That's what happened. And Chuck was like, he took the whole burden and he put it on himself. And I was like, Chuck, my God, do you really want to take this on? Like, because there was no NDA in place. Like, my students could have gone and blasted it all over the internet, but no, they didn't. But what happened was one of the students said, hey, so what do you think about Ugly Sonic being the star of the Chip and Dale movie? And this was like,
that was gonna be my question.
So oh wait, it gets better. So this was like a couple of days after Disney dropped the Chip and Dale movie. So neither Chuck nor Chiako nor I had seen that movie at all. I didn't know. I knew it was there. It was in the universe, but I didn't know anything about it. So we were like, what do you mean the Chip and Dale movie? And he's like, oh, well, Ugly Sonic is one of the stars of the Sonic, of the Chip and Dale movie. And we were like, what? And he's like, yeah. And we were like, no, you mean like Sonic is this? And he's like, no, it's Ugly Sonic. It's the Sonic that broke the internet 2 years ago. And we were like, what the hell? So Chuck was, we were all just like blown away. So immediately after that, Chuck Chiako and I watched the movie and we were like, what? What is this? And so I went back to the students and I told them, I was like, this is a lesson. This is an important life lesson, which is you must never discount anything or anyone, because who would have thought like 2.5 years ago when Ugly Sonic was unleashed on the internet that he would become anything but something in the trash archives of Sega. Now, okay, the Chip and Dale movie was nominated for some Emmys. I don't know if it won. The Emmys were last weekend. But I did see an interview with the director of the Chip and Dale movie who said, there was an interview in one of the entertainment industry trades, and he said, I hope there is a sequel to this movie, but the sequel should be about Ugly Sonic, because he really
stole the show.
He stole the show. He upstaged everybody. So so I don't know what's happening now behind the scenes. Maybe Disney and Sega are in some kind of a negotiation. I don't know.
It falls under something called the parody law.
Yes and no. Yes and no.
There had to have been an agreement, you think?
There was supposed to be. There was supposed to be. I'll tell you, my Sega friends who are close to the situation have begged me not to tell, because I dug deeper and I was like, I have to find out how this happened, because I was very involved with licensing Sonic out to other intellectual properties. For instance, when I worked at Sega, I worked closely with Cartoon Network on licensing the character of Sonic for a Cartoon Network show called OKKO. And yeah. OKKO did an episode where Sonic and Tails were the guest stars. And so that occurrence was a year's worth of negotiations and developments behind the scenes, mostly with me, but then I left to go to Level 5 and other colleagues of mine picked up the mantle. But it doesn't just happen that somebody takes Sonic and puts it in a money generating intellectual property. Even though Sonic Boom was on Cartoon Network at the time and we all had a friendly relationship, but then that's business and Cartoon Network doesn't own Sonic. So we had
Now that I think about it, there has to be some type of working relationship with Sega because he was in Wreck-It Ralph.
Yes, so that was a licensing deal. That was yes, and Sonic's been in a lot of other people's projects where there's a long history of negotiations. Sometimes money has changed hands, sometimes not. Like when Sonic was in Ready Player One, that was during my time there. And so that was just like an honor to be in a Steven Spielberg movie. But then other times, the licensing business is really important to anybody who owns an intellectual property. That's why you see sequels and spin-offs and merchandise and everything, because the initial creation of something nets a specific amount of money, and sometimes it doesn't cover the cost of production and research and development or whatever. And so if you don't try to license out the character or try to do other things with the intellectual property, then it's a loss and people lose their jobs and terrible things happen. So, that's a very important part of the Sonic legacy, is being able to license out the character for various things. And again, it's always a negotiation. Like, it just depends who's asking, what the project is, this, that, and the other. And so, I wanted to find out. I was so curious. I was like, how did this happen? Because this does not seem like something that Sega would allow. And so I did get the story, which I think is a developing story. And my former coworkers begged me not to say anything about it in public. So this is me not saying anything about it in public. But I think it's to be continued to be determined what will happen in the future of Ugly Sonic.
Well, you didn't hear it here first.
Exactly. Exactly. But it's amazing. I mean, don't you think that's amazing that Ugly Sonic could have this life beyond being trashed on the internet?
Yes. Yes. We were amazed to see his ugly self on camera, especially for a Disney movie. But then again, it kind of slipped our minds at the time that they did have him in another Disney movie, just not the ugly version.
Exactly. See, that's the rub. So Ugly Sonic is like, until this Chip and Dale movie, was like a blemish on the reputation. Ugly Sonic was canceled. And you barely ever hear of people coming back from being canceled. He was, right. He was like the ugly stepchild or what have you. And then suddenly he has this resurrection or right. comeback. Somebody
sent them off on the Me Too movement for touching our childhood the wrong way.
Exactly. So, but it's like this beautiful redemption story now that I hope maybe Chuck is able to tell. Maybe Chuck will be able to write his memoirs. Or you can invite him
to come on to Talking Junk with you, and we can do it here.
Oh, yeah. He would love it. Oh, Chuck would. In fact, this is a nice segue into what we're doing next week. Chuck and Chiako and I are involved in a screening series in Los Angeles called the ACA Cinema Project. It's not related to Sonic, Sega, or any of the other Japanese stuff that we've ever worked on, except that it does involve Japanese screen content. So it's a 5-day film extravaganza, 5 different live action Japanese films. 4 of them are brand new. They've never been seen in the US before. One of them is a retrospective film by a famous director called Kureda-san. And so this is an event that's sponsored by the Japanese government to build awareness of their entertainment industry. And so Chuck and Chiako is really the event lead. She is working with the Japanese government to put all this together. And then Chiako invited Chuck and I to be guest speakers. So I'm on a panel on September 28th for a screening called BL Metamorphosis. It's based on a famous manga. And Chuck, golly, I forgot which one Chuck is on one of the other panels, and I can't remember which one it is. But anyway, the event is totally free. It is for entertainment industry employees, professionals only. But if you are an employee or professional or press, also if you cover the entertainment industry, you just go to the website, fill out the registration form, and you're in. It's an in-person event, and it should be really, really interesting. I've seen 3 of the 5 films in the series already, and I'm partial to the one that corresponds with my panel, BL Metamorphosis. That one is my favorite, but they're all really good. So
I wish I had flight points so I can go out there with you.
Yeah, well, you know, there was a version of this event that was done in New York earlier
I'm in Florida now. So.
Oh, you're in Florida.
Yeah, I'm in Florida now.
Bummer. Well, maybe the next stop on this roadshow.
I don't want to take up too much more of your time. We've already took a chunk out of your night. I do want to thank you again for coming on. You've been a wonderful guest. I can't wait to have you on again if you're up for it.
Absolutely. And maybe I can get Chuck and Chiako too. The 3 of us, we can just like gab about our Sonic Sega days. And they worked for a Sega company called Marza Animation Planet. So it's a CG studio that Sega owns. And we all shared office space together in Los Angeles in the branch office, but we all worked really closely together. And then we continue to do so. And Chuck and Chiaco even started a company together after Sega, and they specialize in video game properties and adapting them for the big screen. So I'm sure they would love to come and promote all the stuff that they're working on.
I would love to have them on anytime. And last week I had to cancel a show. So I, just because this is the way I am, I did two shows tonight. So I had a show at 7 Eastern Standard before you. So I don't mind at all moving my calendar around to make way for great content.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'll let them know. I think they would be delighted. They would be delighted.
The pleasure will be all mine. And don't go nowhere. Let me close it out for the viewers real quick. Don't go nowhere just yet. Thank you very much again for coming on.
Thank you. This has been such a pleasure.
Pleasure was all ours. And I have all of Marlene's websites up right here. muckrack.com/Marlene-Sharp. filmfreeway.com/Marlene Sharp, and the pink it's pinkpoodleproductions.com. so you can go and check all of these websites out and immerse yourself in everything Marlene, or you can hit her up on IG, but I don't know how she'll feel about you sliding in her DMs, so stay out of there. But again, another great Friday night, another wonderful guest. And I want to urge Marlene to think of us the next time her animations team needs a voiceover, because we're here for it. We'll knock it out the park. We do our best here. Always. And let me close it out by saying, get you an Excalibur. It's the bee's knees. And all we do is dizzle. All we do. So be sure to tune in next week when we have another great guest for you right here on the Talking Junk Network. Thanks a bunch for tuning in. Disney, acknowledge me. No, don't. I don't want to be sued. Have a great night.